helps to calm me as I try to prepare for the next hour. The time allotted for the tributes to say goodbye to their loved ones. I cannot afford to get upset, to leave this room with puffy eyes and a red nose. Crying is not an option. There will be more cameras at the train station. My sister and my mother come first. I reach out to Prim and she climbs on my lap, her arms around my neck, head on my shoulder, just like she did when she was a toddler. My mother sits beside me and wraps her arms around us. For a few minutes, we say nothing. Then I start telling them all the things they must remember to do, now that I will not be there to do it for them. Prim is not to take any tesserae. They can get by, if they're careful, on selling Prim's goat milk and cheese and the small apothecary business my mother now runs for the people in the seam. Gail will get her the herbs she doesn't grow herself, but she must be very careful to describe them, because he's not as familiar with them as I am. He'll also bring them game. He and I made a pact about this a year or so ago, and will probably not ask for compensation, but they should thank him with some kind of trade, like milk or medicine. I don't bother suggesting Prim learn to hunt. I tried to teach her a couple of times, and it was disastrous. The woods terrified her, and whenever I shot something, she'd get teary and talk about how we might be able to heal it if we got it home soon enough. But she makes out well with her goat, so I concentrate on that. When I'm done with instructions about fuel and trading and staying in school, I turn to my mother and grip her arm, hard.
Listen to me. Are you listening to me?
She nods, alarmed by my intensity. She must know what's coming.
You can't leave again, I say.
My mother's eyes find the floor.
I know, I won't. I couldn't help what—
Well, you have to help at this time. You can't clock out and leave Prim on her own. There's no me now to keep you both alive. It doesn't matter what happens. Whatever you see on the screen, you have to promise me you'll fight through it.
My voice has risen to a shout. In it is all the anger, all the fear I felt at her abandonment. She pulls her arm from my grasp, moved to anger herself now.
I was ill. I could have treated myself if I'd had the medicine I have now.
That part about her being ill might be true. I've seen her bring back people suffering from immobilizing sadness since. Perhaps it is a sickness, but it's one we can't afford.
Then take it and take care of her, I say.
I'll be all right, Katniss, says Prim, clasping my face in her hands. But you have to take care, too. You're so fast and brave. Maybe you can win.
I can't win. Prim must know that in her heart. The competition will be far beyond my abilities. Kids from wealthier districts, where winning is a huge honor, who've been trained their whole lives for this. Boys who are 2 to 3 times my size. Girls who know 20 different ways to kill you with a knife. Oh, there'll be people like me, too. People to weed out before the real fun begins.
Maybe,
I say, because I can hardly tell my mother to carry on if I've already given up myself. Besides, it isn't in my nature to go down without a fight, even when things seem insurmountable. Then we'd be rich as Haymitch.
I don't care if we're rich. I just want you to come home. You will try, won't you? Really, really try?
Asks Prim. Really, really try. I swear it, I say, and I know, because of Prim, I'll have to. And then the peacekeeper is at the door, signaling our time is up, and we're all hugging one another so hard it hurts. And all I'm saying is, I love you both. And they're saying it back, and then the peacekeeper orders them out, and the door closes. I bury my head in one of the velvet pillows, as if this can block the whole thing out. Someone else enters the room, and when I look up, I'm surprised to see it's the baker, Peter Mellark's father. I can't believe he's come to visit me.
After all, I'll be trying to kill his son soon. But we do know each other a bit, and he knows Prim even better. When she sells her goat cheeses at the hob, she puts two of them aside for him, and he gives her a generous amount of bread in return. We always wait to trade with him when his witch of a wife isn't around, because he's so much nicer. I feel certain he would never have hit his son the way she did over the burned bread. But why has he come to see me? The baker sits awkwardly on the edge of one of the plush chairs. He's a big, broad-shouldered man, with burn scars from years at the ovens. He must have just said goodbye to his son. He pulls a white paper package from his jacket pocket and holds it out to me. I open it and find cookies. These are a luxury we can never afford.
Thank you, I say.
The baker's not a very talkative man, in the best of times, and today he has no words at all.
I had some of your bread this morning. My friend Gail gave you a squirrel for it.
He nods, as if remembering the squirrel.
Not your best trade, I say.
He shrugs, as if it couldn't possibly matter. Then I can't think of anything else, so we sit in silence until a peacemaker summons him. He rises and coughs to clear his throat.
I'll keep an eye on the little girl. Make sure she's eating.
I feel some of the pressure in my chest lighten at his words. People deal with me, but they are genuinely fond of Prim. Maybe there will be enough fondness to keep her alive. My next guest is also unexpected. Madge walks straight to me. She is not weepy or evasive. Instead, there's an urgency about her tone that surprises me.
They let you wear one thing from your district in the arena. One thing to remind you of home. Will you wear this?
She holds out the circular gold pin that was on her dress earlier. I hadn't paid much attention to it before, but now I see it's a small bird in flight.
Your pin, I say.
Wearing a token from my district is about the last thing on my mind.
Here, I'll put it on your dress, all right?
Madge doesn't wait for an answer. She just leans in and fixes the bird to my dress.
Promise you'll wear it into the arena, Katniss, she asks. Promise.
Yes, I say.
Cookies. A pin.
I'm getting all kinds of gifts today. Madge gives me one more. A kiss on the cheek. Then she's gone, and I'm left thinking that maybe Madge really has been my friend all along. Finally, Gale is here. And maybe there is nothing romantic between us, but when he opens his arms, I don't hesitate to go into them. His body is familiar to me, the way it moves, the smell of wood smoke. Even the sound of his heart beating, I know from quiet moments on a hunt. But this is the first time I really feel it, lean and hard-muscled against my own.
Listen, he says. Getting a knife should be pretty easy. But you've got to get your hands on a bow. That's your best chance.
They don't always have bows, I say.
Thinking of the year, there were only horrible spiked maces that the tributes had to bludgeon one another to death with.
Then make one, says Gale. Even a weak bow is better than no bow at all.
I have tried copying my father's bows with poor results. It's not that easy. Even he had to scrap his own work sometimes.
I don't even know if there'll be wood, I say.
Another year, they tossed everybody into a landscape of nothing but boulders and sand and scruffy bushes. I particularly hated that year. Many contestants were bitten by venomous snakes or went insane from thirst.
There's almost always some wood, Gale says. Since that year, half of them died of cold. Not much entertainment in that.
It's true. We spent one Hunger Games watching the players freeze to death at night. You could hardly see them because they were just huddled in balls and had no wood for fires or torches or anything. It was considered very anticlimactic in the capital,
all those quiet, bloodless deaths. Since then, there's usually been wood to make fires.
Yes, there's usually some, I say.
Katniss, it's just hunting. You're the best hunter I know, says Gale.
It's not just hunting. They're armed. They think, I say.
So do you. And you've had more practice, real practice, he says. You know how to kill.
Not people, I say.
How different can it be, really? Says Gale grimly.
The awful thing is that if I can forget their people, it will be no different at all. The peacekeepers are back too soon, and Gale asks for more time, but they're taking him away, and I start to panic. Don't let them starve, I cry out, clinging to his hand.
I won't. You know I won't.
Katniss, remember, I...
he says, and they yank us apart and slam the door.
And I'll never know what it was he wanted me to remember. It's a short ride from the Justice Building to the train station. I've never been in a car before. Rarely even ridden in wagons. In the Seam, we travel on foot.
I've been right not to cry.
The station is swarming with reporters with their insect-like cameras trained directly on my face. But I've had a lot of practice at wiping my face clean of emotions, and I do this now. I catch a glimpse of myself on the television screen on the wall that's airing my arrival live, and feel gratified that I appear almost bored. Peeta Mellark, on the other hand, has obviously been crying, and interestingly enough, does not seem to be trying to cover it up. I immediately wonder if this will be his strategy in the games.
To appear weak and frightened, to reassure the other tributes that he is no competition at all, and then come out fighting. This worked very well for a girl, Joanna Mason, from District 7 a few years back. She seemed like such a sniveling, cowardly fool that no one bothered about her, until there were only a handful of contestants left. It turned out she could kill viciously. Pretty clever, the way she played it. But this seems an odd strategy for Peeta Mellark, because he's a baker's son. All those years of having enough to eat and hauling bread trays around have made him broad-shouldered and strong. It will take an awful lot of weeping to convince anyone to overlook him. We have to stand for a few minutes in the doorway of the train while the cameras gobble up our images. Then we're allowed inside and the doors close mercifully behind us. The train begins to move at once. The speed initially takes my breath away. Of course, I've never been on a train, as travel between the districts is forbidden except for officially sanctioned duties. For us, that's mainly transporting coal. But this is no ordinary coal train. It's one of the high-speed capital models that average 250 miles per hour. Our journey to the capital will take less than a day. In school, they tell us the capital was built in a place once called the Rockies. District 12 was in a region known as Appalachia. Even hundreds of years ago, they mined coal here, which is why our miners have to dig so deep. Somehow it all comes back to coal at school. Besides basic reading and math, most of our instruction is coal-related, except for the weekly lecture on the history of Panem. It's mostly a lot of blather about what we owe the capital. I know there must be more than they're telling us, an actual account of what happened during the rebellion, but I don't spend much time thinking about it. Whatever the truth is, I don't see how it will help me get food on the table. The tribute train is fancier than even the room in the Justice Building. We are each given our own chambers that have a bedroom, a dressing area, and a private bathroom with hot and cold running water. We don't have hot water at home unless we boil it. There are drawers filled with fine clothes. And Effie Trinket tells me to do anything I want, wear anything I want, everything is at my disposal. Just be ready for supper in an hour. I peel off my mother's blue dress and take a hot shower. I've never had a shower before. It's like being in a summer rain, only warmer. I dress in a dark green shirt and pants. At the last minute, I remember Madge's little gold pin. For the first time, I get a good look at it. It's as if someone fashioned a small golden bird and then attached a ring around it. The bird is connected to the ring only by its wing tips. I suddenly recognize it. A mockingjay. They're funny birds, and something of a slap in the face to the capital. During the rebellion, the capital bred a series of genetically altered animals as weapons. The common term for them was mutations, or sometimes mutts for short. One was a special bird called a jabberjay that had the ability to memorize and repeat whole human conversations. They were homing birds, exclusively male, that were released into regions where the capital's enemies were known to be hiding. After the birds gathered words, they'd fly back to the centers to be recorded. It took people a while to realize what was going on in the districts, how private conversations were being transmitted. Then, of course, the rebels fed the capital endless lies, and the joke was on it. So the centers were shut down, and the birds were abandoned to die off in the wild. Only they didn't die off. Instead, the jabberjays mated with female mockingbirds, creating a whole new species that could replicate both bird whistles and human melodies. They had lost the ability to enunciate words, but could still mimic a range of human vocal sounds, from a child's high-pitched warble to a man's deep tones. And they could recreate songs. Not just a few notes, but whole songs with multiple verses if you had the patience to sing them, and if they liked your voice. My father was particularly fond of mockingjays. When we went hunting, he would whistle or sing complicated songs to them, and after a polite pause, they'd always sing back. Not everyone is treated with such respect, but whenever my father sang, all the birds in the area would fall silent and listen. His voice was that beautiful, high and clear, and so filled with life it made you want to laugh and cry at the same time. I could never bring myself to continue the practice after he was gone. Still, there's something comforting about the little bird. It's like having a piece of my father with me, protecting me. I fasten the pin onto my shirt, and with the dark green fabric as a background, I can almost imagine the mockingjay flying through the trees. Effie Trinket comes to collect me for supper. I follow her through the narrow rocking corridor, into a dining room with polished, paneled walls. There's a table where all the dishes are highly breakable. Peter Mellark sits waiting for us, the chair next to him empty.
"Where's Haymitch?"
asks Effie Trinket brightly.
"Last time I saw him, he said he was going to take a nap," says Peter.
"Well, it's been an exhausting day," says Effie Trinket.
I think she's relieved by Haymitch's absence, and who can blame her? The supper comes in courses. A thick carrot soup, green salad, lamb chops, and mashed potatoes, cheese and fruit, a chocolate cake. Throughout the meal, Effie Trinket keeps reminding us to save space because there's more to come. But I'm stuffing myself because I've never had food like this, so good and so much. And because probably the best thing I can do between now and the games is put on a few pounds.
"At least you two have decent manners," says Effie as we're finishing the main course. "The pair last year ate everything with their hands like a couple of savages. It completely upset my digestion."
The pair last year were two kids from the seam who'd never, not one day of their lives, had enough to eat. And when they did have food, table manners were surely the last thing on their minds. Peter's a baker's son. My mother taught Prim and I to eat properly, so yes, I can handle a fork and knife. But I hate Effie Trinket's comments so much I make a point of eating the rest of my meal with my fingers. Then I wipe my hands on the tablecloth.
This makes her purse her lips tightly together. Now that the meal's over, I'm fighting to keep the food down. I can see Peeta's looking a little green, too. Neither of our stomachs is used to such rich fare. But if I can hold down Greasy Say's concoction of mice meat, pig entrails, and tree bark, a winter specialty, I'm determined to hang on to this. We go to another compartment to watch the recap of the reapings across Panem. They try to stagger them throughout the day so a person could conceivably watch the whole thing live, but only people in the capital could really do that, since none of them have to attend reapings themselves. One by one we see the other reapings, the names called, the volunteers stepping forward or, more often, not. We examine the faces of the kids who will be our competition. A few stand out in my mind. A monstrous boy who lunges forward to volunteer from District 2. A fox-faced girl with sleek red hair from District 5. A boy with a crippled foot from District 10. And most hauntingly, a 12-year-old girl from District 11. She has dark brown skin and eyes, but other than that, she's very like Prim in size and demeanor. Only when she mounts the stage and they ask for volunteers, all you can hear is the wind whistling through the decrepit buildings around her. There's no one willing to take her place. Last of all, they show District 12. Prim being called, me running forward to volunteer. You can't miss the desperation in my voice as I shove Prim behind me, as if I'm afraid no one will hear and they'll take Prim away. But of course they do hear. I see Gale pulling her off me and watch myself mount the stage. The commentators are not sure what to say about the crowd's refusal to applaud. The silent salute. One says that District 12 has always been a bit backward, but that local customs can be charming. As if on cue, Haymitch falls off the stage, and they groan comically. Peeta's name is drawn, and he quietly takes his place. We shake hands. They cut to the anthem again, and the program ends. Effie Trinket is disgruntled about the state her wig was in.
Your mentor has a lot to learn about presentation. A lot about televised behavior.
Peeta unexpectedly laughs.
He was drunk, says Peeta. He's drunk every year.
Every day,
I add. I can't help smirking a little. Effie Trinket makes it sound like Haymitch just has somewhat rough manners that could be corrected with a few tips from her.
Yes, hisses Effie Trinket. How odd you two find it amusing. You know, your mentor is your lifeline to the world in these games. The one who advises you, lines up your sponsors, and dictates the presentation of any gifts. Haymitch can well be the difference between your life and your death.
Just then, Haymitch staggers into the compartment.
I miss supper, he says in a slurred voice.
Then he vomits all over the expensive carpet and falls in the mess.
So laugh away, says Effie Trinket.
She hops in her pointy shoes around the pool of vomit and flees the room. Chapter 4. For a few moments, Peeta and I take in the scene of our mentor trying to rise out of the slippery, vile stuff from his stomach. The reek of vomit and raw spirits almost brings my dinner up. We exchange a glance. Obviously, Haymitch isn't much, but Effie Trinket is right about one thing. Once we're in the arena, he's all we've got. As if by some unspoken agreement, Peeta and I each take one of Haymitch's arms and help him to his feet.
I tripped? Haymitch
asks.
Smells bad.
He wipes his hand on his nose, smearing his face with vomit.
Let's get you back to your room, says Peeta. Clean you up a bit.
We half-led, half-carry Haymitch back to his compartment. since we can't exactly set him down on the embroidered bedspread. We haul him into the bathtub and turn the shower on him. He hardly notices.
It's okay, Peeta says to me. I'll take it from here.
I can't help feeling a little grateful, since the last thing I want to do is strip down Haymitch, wash the vomit out of his chest hair, and tuck him into bed. Possibly Peeta is trying to make a good impression on him, to be his favorite once the games begin. But judging by the state he's in, Haymitch will have no memory of this tomorrow.
All right, I say. I can send one of the capital people to help you. There's any number on the train. Cooking for us, waiting on us, guarding us. Taking care of us is their job.
No, I don't want them, says Peeta. I nod and head to my own room. I understand how Peeta feels. I can't stand the sight of the capital people myself. But making them deal with Haymitch might be a small form of revenge. So I'm pondering the reason why he insists on taking care of Haymitch, and all of a sudden I think, it's because he's being kind, just as he was kind to give me the bread. The idea pulls me up short. A kind Peeta Mellark is far more dangerous to me than an unkind one. Kind people have a way of working their way inside me and rooting there. And I can't let Peeta do this. Not where we're going. So I decide, from this moment on, to have as little as possible to do with the baker's son. When I get back to my room, the train is pausing at a platform to refuel. I quickly open the window, toss the cookies Peeta's father gave me out of the train, and slam the glass shut. No more. No more of either of them. Unfortunately, the packet of cookies hits the ground and bursts open in a patch of dandelions by the track. I only see the image for a moment, because the train is off again, but it's enough. Enough to remind me of that other dandelion in the schoolyard years ago. I had just turned away from Peeta Mellark's bruised face when I saw the dandelion, and I knew hope wasn't lost. I plucked it carefully and hurried home. I grabbed a bucket and Prim's hand and headed to the meadow, and yes, it was dotted with the golden-headed weeds. After we'd harvested those, we scrounged along inside the fence for probably a mile until we'd filled the bucket with the dandelion greens, stems, and flowers. That night, we gorged ourselves on dandelion salad and the rest of the bakery bread.
What else? Prim asked me. What other food can we find?
All kinds of things, I promised her. I just have to remember them.
My mother had a book she'd brought with her from the apothecary shop. The pages were made of old parchment and covered in ink drawings of plants. Neat handwritten blocks told their names, where to gather them, when they came in bloom, their medical uses. But my father added other entries to the book. Plants for eating, not healing, dandelions, pokeweed, wild onions, pines. Prim and I spent the rest of the night poring over those pages. The next day we were off school. For a while I hung around the edges of the meadow, but finally I worked up the courage to go under the fence. It was the first time I'd been there alone, without my father's weapons to protect me. But I retrieved the small bow and arrows he'd made me from a hollow tree. I probably didn't go more than 20 yards into the woods that day. Most of the time, I perched up in the branches of an old oak, hoping for game to come by. After several hours, I had the good luck to kill a rabbit. I'd shot a few rabbits before, with my father's guidance. But this I'd done on my own. We hadn't had meat in months. The sight of the rabbit seemed to stir something in my mother. She roused herself, skinned the carcass, and made a stew with the meat and some more greens Prim had gathered. Then she acted confused and went back to bed. But when the stew was done, we made her eat a bowl.
The woods became our savior, and each day I went a bit farther into its arms. It was slow going at first, but I was determined to feed us. I stole eggs from nests, caught fish in nets, sometimes managed to shoot a squirrel or rabbit for stew, and gathered the various plants that sprung up beneath my feet. Plants are tricky. Many are edible, but one false mouthful and you're dead. I checked and double-checked the plants I harvested with my father's pictures. I kept us alive. Any sign of danger, a distant howl, the inexplicable break of a branch, sent me flying back to the fence at first. Then I began to risk climbing trees to escape the wild dogs that quickly got bored and moved on. Bears and cats lived deeper in, perhaps disliking the sooty reek of our district. On May 8th, I went to the Justice Building, signed up for my tesserie, and pulled home my first batch of grain and oil in Prim's toy wagon. On the 8th of every month, I was entitled to do the same. I couldn't stop hunting and gathering, of course. The grain was not enough to live on, and there were other things to buy, soap and milk and thread. What we didn't absolutely have to eat, I began to trade at the hob. It was frightening to enter that place without my father at my side, but people had respected him, and they accepted me. Game was game, after all, no matter who'd shot it. I also sold at the back doors of the wealthier clients in town, trying to remember what my father had told me and learning a few new tricks as well. The butcher would buy my rabbits, but not squirrels. The baker enjoyed squirrel, but would only trade for one if his wife wasn't around. The head peacekeeper loved wild turkey. The mayor had a passion for strawberries. In late summer, I was washing up in a pond when I noticed the plants growing around me. Tall with leaves like arrowheads. Blossoms with three white petals. I knelt down in the water, my fingers digging into the soft mud, and I pulled up handfuls of the roots. Small bluish tubers that don't look like much but boiled or baked are as good as any potato. Catnip, I said aloud. It's the plant I was named for. And I heard my father's voice joking. Long as you can find yourself, you'll never starve. I spent hours stirring up the pond bed with my toes and a stick, gathering the tubers that floated to the top. That night, we feasted on fish and catnip roots, until we were all, for the first time in months, full. Slowly, my mother returned to us. She began to clean and cook and preserve some of the food I brought in for winter. People traded us or paid money for her medical remedies. One day, I heard her singing. Prim was thrilled to have her back, but I kept watching, waiting for her to disappear on us again. I didn't trust her, and some small gnarled place inside me hated her for her weakness, for her neglect, for the months she had put us through. Prim forgave her, but I had taken a step back from my mother, put up a wall to protect myself from needing her, and nothing was ever the same between us again. Now I was going to die, without that ever being set right. I thought of how I had yelled at her today in the Justice Building. I had told her I loved her too, though, so maybe it would all balance out. For a while I stand staring out the train window, wishing I could open it again, but unsure of what would happen at such high speed. In the distance, I see the lights of another district. 7, 10, I don't know. I think about the people in their houses, settling in for bed. I imagine my home, with its shutters drawn tight. What are they doing now, my mother and Prim? Were they able to eat supper? The fish stew and the strawberries? Or did it lay untouched on their plates? Did they watch the recap of the day's events on the battered old TV that sits on the table against the wall? Surely there were more tears. Is my mother holding up, being strong for Prim? Or has she already started to slip away, leaving the weight of the world on my sister's fragile shoulders?
Prim will undoubtedly sleep with my mother tonight. The thought of that scruffy old buttercup posting himself on the bed to watch over Prim comforts me. If she cries, he will nose his way into her arms and curl up there until she calms down and falls asleep. I'm so glad I didn't drown him. Imagining my home makes me ache with loneliness. This day has been endless. Could Gail and I have been eating blackberries only this morning? It seems like a lifetime ago. Like a long dream that deteriorated into a nightmare. Maybe, if I go to sleep, I will wake up back in District 12, where I belong. Probably the drawers hold any number of nightgowns, but I just strip off my shirt and pants and climb into bed in my underwear. The sheets are made of soft, silky fabric. A thick, fluffy comforter gives immediate warmth. If I'm going to cry, now is the time to do it. By morning, I'll be able to wash the damage done by the tears from my face. But no tears come. I'm too tired or too numb to cry. The only thing I feel is a desire to be somewhere else. So I let the train rock me into oblivion. Gray light is leaking through the curtains when the rapping rouses me. I hear Effie Trinket's voice calling me to rise.
Up, up, up! It's going to be a big, big, big day!
I try and imagine for a moment what it must be like inside that woman's head. What thoughts fill her waking hours? What dreams come to her at night? I have no idea. I put the green outfit back on, since it's not really dirty, just slightly crumpled from spending the night on the floor. My fingers trace the circle around the little gold mockingjay, and I think of the woods, and of my father, and of my mother and Prim waking up, having to get on with things. I slept in the elaborate braided hair my mother did for the reaping, and it doesn't look too bad, so I just leave it up. It doesn't matter. We can't be far from the capital now. And once we reach the city, my stylist will dictate my look for the opening ceremonies tonight anyway. I just hope I get one who doesn't think nudity is the last word in fashion. As I enter the dining car, Effie Trinket brushes by me with a cup of black coffee. She's muttering obscenities under her breath. Haymitch, his face puffy and red from the previous day's indulgences, is chuckling. Peter holds a roll and looks somewhat embarrassed.
"Sit down. Sit down," says Haymitch, waving me over.
The moment I slide into my chair, I'm served an enormous platter of food. Eggs, ham, piles of fried potatoes. A tureen of fruit sits in ice to keep it chilled. The basket of rolls they set before me would keep my family going for a week. There's an elegant glass of orange juice. At least, I think it's orange juice. I've only even tasted an orange once, at New Year's when my father bought one as a special treat. A cup of coffee. My mother adores coffee, which we could almost never afford, but it only tastes bitter and thin to me. A rich brown cup of something I've never seen.
"They call it hot chocolate," says Peter. "It's good."
I take a sip of the hot, sweet, creamy liquid, and a shudder runs through me. Even though the rest of the meal beckons, I ignore it until I've drained my cup. Then I stuff down every mouthful I can hold, which is a substantial amount, being careful to not overdo it on the richest stuff. One time, my mother told me that I always eat like I'll never see food again. And I said, "I won't unless I bring it home." That shut her up. When my stomach feels like it's about to split open, I lean back and take in my breakfast companions. Peter is still eating, breaking off bits of roll and dipping them in hot chocolate. Haymitch hasn't paid much attention to his platter, but he's knocking back a glass of red juice that he keeps thinning with a clear liquid from a bottle. Judging by the fumes, it's some kind of spirit. I don't know Haymitch, but I've seen him often enough in the hob, tossing handfuls of money on the counter of the woman who sells white liquor. He'll be incoherent by the time we reach the capital. I realize I detest Haymitch. No wonder the District 12 tributes never stand a chance. It isn't just that we've been underfed and lack training. Some of our tributes have still been strong enough to make a go of it. But we rarely get sponsors, and he's a big part of the reason why. The rich people who back tributes, either because they're betting on them or simply for the bragging rights of picking a winner, expect someone classier than Haymitch to deal with. "So you're supposed to give us advice," I say to Haymitch.
"Here's some advice. Stay alive," says Haymitch, and then bursts out laughing.
I exchange a look with Peeta before I remember I'm having nothing more to do with him. I'm surprised to see the hardness in his eyes. He generally seems so mild.
"That's very funny," says Peeta.
Suddenly he lashes out at the glass in Haymitch's hand. It shatters on the floor, sending the blood-red liquid running toward the back of the train.
"Only not to us."
Haymitch considers this a moment, then punches Peeta in the jaw, knocking him from his chair. When he turns back to reach for the spirits, I drive my knife into the table between his hand and the bottle, barely missing his fingers. I brace myself to deflect his hit, but it doesn't come. Instead, he sits back and squints at us.
"Well, what's this?" says Haymitch. "Did I actually get a pair of fighters this year?"
Peeta rises from the floor and scoops up a handful of ice from under the fruit tureen. He starts to raise it to the red mark on his jaw.
"No," says Haymitch, stopping him. "Let the bruise show. The audience will think you've mixed it up with another tribute before you've even made it to the arena."
"That's against the rules," says Peeta.
"Only if they catch you, that bruise will say you fought. You weren't caught. Even better," says Haymitch.
He turns to me.
"Can you hit anything with that knife besides the table?"
The bow and arrow is my weapon, but I've spent a fair amount of time throwing knives as well. Sometimes, if I've wounded an animal with an arrow, it's better to get a knife into it too before I approach it. I realize that if I want Haymitch's attention, this is my moment to make an impression. I yank the knife out of the table, get a grip on the blade, and then throw it into the wall across the room. I was actually just hoping to get a good solid stick, but it lodges in the seam between two panels, making me look a lot better than I am.
"Stand over here, both of you," says Haymitch,
nodding to the middle of the room. We obey, and he circles us, prodding us like animals at times, checking our muscles, examining our faces.
"Well, you're not entirely hopeless. Seem fit, and once the stylist get hold of you, you'll be attractive enough."
Peeta and I don't question this. The Hunger Games aren't a beauty contest, but the best-looking tributes always seem to pull more sponsors.
"All right, I'll make a deal with you. You don't interfere with my drinking, and I'll stay sober enough to help you," says Haymitch. "But you have to do exactly what I say."
It's not much of a deal, but still a giant step forward from 10 minutes ago, when we had no guide at all.
"Fine," says Peeta.
"So help us," I say.
"When we get to the arena, what's the best strategy at the cornucopia for someone?"
"One thing at a time. In a few minutes, we'll be pulling into the station. You'll be put in the hands of your stylists. You're not going to like what they do to you, but no matter what it is, don't resist," says Haymitch.
"But," I begin.
"No buts. Don't resist," says Haymitch.
He takes the bottle of spirits from the table and leaves the car. As the door swings shut behind him, the car goes dark. There are still a few lights inside, but outside it's as if night has fallen again. I realize we must be in the tunnel that runs up through the mountains into the capital.
The mountains form a natural barrier between the capital and the eastern districts. It is almost impossible to enter from the east except through the tunnels. This geographical advantage was a major factor in the districts losing the war that led to my being a tribute today. Since the rebels had to scale the mountains, they were easy targets for the capital's air forces. Peter, Mellark, and I stand in silence as the train speeds along. The tunnel goes on and on, and I think of the tons of rock separating me from the sky, and my chest tightens. I hate being encased in stone this way. It reminds me of the mines and my father, trapped, unable to reach sunlight, buried forever in the darkness. The train finally begins to slow, and suddenly bright light floods the compartment. We can't help it. Both Peter and I run to the window to see what we've only seen on television, the capital, the ruling city of Panem. The cameras haven't lied about its grandeur. If anything, they have not quite captured the magnificence of the glistening buildings in a rainbow of hues that tower into the air, the shiny cars that roll down the wide paved streets, the oddly dressed people with bizarre hair and painted faces who have never missed a meal. All the colors seem artificial, the pinks too deep, the greens too bright, the yellows painful to the eyes, like the flat round discs of hard candy we can never afford to buy at the tiny sweet shop in District 12. The people begin to point at us eagerly as they recognize a tribute train rolling into the city. I step away from the window, sickened by their excitement, knowing they can't wait to watch us die. But Peter holds his ground, actually waving and smiling at the gawking crowd. He only stops when the train pulls into the station, blocking us from their view. He sees me staring at him and shrugs.
"Who knows?" he says. "One of them may be rich."
I have misjudged him. I think of his actions since the reaping began. The friendly squeeze of my hand. His father showing up with the cookies and promising to feed Prim. Did Peter put him up to that? His tears at the station. Volunteering to wash Hamish, but then challenging him this morning when apparently the nice guy approach had failed. And now the waving at the window, already trying to win the crowd. All of the pieces are still fitting together, but I sense he has a plan forming. He hasn't accepted his death. He is already fighting hard to stay alive. Which also means that kind Peter Mellark, the boy who gave me the bread, is fighting hard to kill me. Chapter 5.
Rip!
I grit my teeth as Venia, a woman with aqua hair and gold tattoos above her eyebrows, yanks a strip of fabric from my leg, tearing out the hair beneath it.
Sorry?
She pipes in her silly capital accent.
You're just so hairy.
Why do these people speak in such a high pitch? Why do their jaws barely open when they talk? Why do the ends of their sentences go up as if they're asking a question? Odd vowels, clipped words, and always a hiss on the letter S. No wonder it's impossible not to mimic them. Venia makes what's supposed to be a sympathetic face.
Good news, though. This is the last one. Ready?
I get a grip on the edges of the table I'm seated on and nod. The final swath of my leg hair is uprooted in a painful jerk. I've been in the remake center for more than 3 hours, and I still haven't met my stylist. Apparently, he has no interest in seeing me until Venia and the other members of my prep team have addressed some obvious problems. This has included scrubbing down my body with a gritty foam that has removed not only dirt, but at least 3 layers of skin, turning my nails into uniform shapes, and primarily ridding my body of hair. My legs, arms, torso, underarms, and parts of my eyebrows have been stripped of the stuff,
leaving me like a plucked bird, ready for roasting. I don't like it. My skin feels sore and tingling and intensely vulnerable. But I have kept my side of the bargain with Haymitch, and no objection has crossed my lips.
"You're doing very well,"
says some guy named Flavius. He gives his orange corkscrew locks a shake and applies a fresh coat of purple lipstick to his mouth.
"If there's one thing we can't stand, it's a whiner. Grease her down."
Venia and Octavia, a plump woman whose entire body has been dyed a pale shade of pea green, rub me down with a lotion that first stings but then soothes my raw skin. Then they pull me from the table, removing the thin robe I've been allowed to wear off and on. I stand there, completely naked, as the three circle me, wielding tweezers to remove any last bits of hair. I know I should be embarrassed, but they're so unlike people that I'm no more self-conscious than if a trio of oddly colored birds were pecking around my feet. The three step back and admire their work.
"Excellent! You almost look like a human being now," says Flavius, and they all laugh.
I force my lips up into a smile to show how grateful I am.
"Thank you,"
I say sweetly. "We don't have much cause to look nice in District 12. This wins them over completely.
"Of course you don't, you poor darling,"
says Octavia, clasping her hands together in distress for me.
"But don't worry," says Venia. "By the time Cinna is through with you, you're going to be absolutely gorgeous."
"We promise."
"You know, now that we've gotten rid of all the hair and filth, you're not horrible at all,"
says Flavius encouragingly.
"Let's call Cinna."
They dart out of the room. It's hard to hate my prep team. They're such total idiots. And yet, in an odd way, I know they're sincerely trying to help me. I look at the cold white walls and floor and resist the impulse to retrieve my robe. But this Cinna, my stylist, will surely make me remove it at once. Instead, my hands go to my hairdo, the one area of my body my prep team had been told to leave alone. My fingers stroke the silky braids my mother so carefully arranged. My mother. I left her blue dress and shoes on the floor of my train car, never thinking about retrieving them, of trying to hold on to a piece of her, of home. Now I wish I had. The door opens and a young man who must be Cinna enters. I'm taken aback by how normal he looks. Most of the stylists they interview on television are so dyed, stenciled, and surgically altered they're grotesque. But Cinna's close-cropped hair appears to be its natural shade of brown. He is in a simple black shirt and pants. The only concession to self-alteration seems to be the metallic gold eyeliner that has been applied with a light hand. It brings out the flecks of gold in his green eyes. And despite my disgust with the capital and their hideous fashions, I can't help thinking how attractive it looks. "Hello, Katniss. I'm Cinna, your stylist," he says in a quiet voice, somewhat lacking in the capital's affectations.
"Hello,"
I venture cautiously.
"Just give me a moment, all right?"
he asks. He walks around my naked body, not touching me, but taking in every inch of it with his eyes. I resist the impulse to cross my arms over my chest.
"Who did your hair?"
"My mother," I say.
"It's beautiful. Classic, really. And an almost perfect balance with your profile. She has very clever fingers," he says.
I had expected someone flamboyant, someone older, trying desperately to look young, someone who viewed me as a piece of meat to be prepared for a platter. Cinna has met none of these expectations.
"You're new, aren't you? I don't think I've seen you before,"
I say. Most of the stylists are familiar, constants in the ever-changing pool of tributes. Some have been around my whole life. "Yes, this is my first year in the games," says Cinna.
So they gave you District 12, I say. Newcomers generally end up with us, the least desirable district. I asked for District 12. He says without further explanation, "Why don't you put on your robe and we'll have a chat?" Pulling on my robe, I follow him through a door into a sitting room. Two red couches face off over a low table. Three walls are blank, the fourth is entirely glass, providing a window to the city. I can see by the light that it must be around noon, although the sunny sky has turned overcast. Cinna invites me to sit on one of the couches and takes his place across from me. He presses a button on the side of the table. The top splits, and from below rises a second tabletop that holds our lunch. Chicken and chunks of oranges cooked in a creamy sauce, laid on a bed of pearly white grain, tiny green peas and onions, rolls shaped like flowers, and for dessert, a pudding the color of honey. I try to imagine assembling this meal myself back home. Chickens are too expensive, but I could make do with a wild turkey. I'd need to shoot a second turkey to trade for an orange. Goat's milk would have to substitute for cream. We can grow peas in the garden. I'd have to get wild onions from the woods. I don't recognize the grain. Our own tessera ration cooks down to an unattractive brown mush. Fancy rolls would mean another trade with the baker, perhaps for two or three squirrels. As for the pudding, I can't even guess what's in it. Days of hunting and gathering for this one meal, and even then it would be a poor substitution for the capital version. What must it be like, I wonder, to live in a world where food appears at the press of a button? How would I spend the hours I now commit to combing the woods for sustenance if it were so easy to come by? What do they all do all day, these people in the capital, besides decorating their bodies and waiting around for a new shipment of tributes to roll in and die for their entertainment? I look up and find Cinna's eyes trained on mine. "How despicable we must seem to you," he says. Has he seen this in my face or somehow read my thoughts? He's right, though. The whole rotten lot of them is despicable.
"No matter," says Cinna. "So, Katniss, about your costume for the opening ceremonies. My partner, Portia, is the stylist for your fellow tribute, Peter, and our current thought is to dress you in complimentary costumes," says Cinna. "As you know, it's customary to reflect the flavor of the district.
For the opening ceremonies, you're supposed to wear something that suggests your district's principal industry. District 11, agriculture. District 4, fishing. District 3, factories. This means that coming from District 12, Pete and I will be in some kind of coal miner's get-up. Since the baggy miner's jumpsuits are not particularly becoming, our tributes usually end up in skimpy outfits and hats with headlamps. One year, our tributes were stark naked and covered in black powder to represent coal dust. It's always dreadful and does nothing to win favor with the crowd. I prepare myself for the worst."
"So I'll be in a coal miner outfit?"
I ask, hoping it won't be indecent. "Not exactly. You see, Portia and I think that coal miner thing's very overdone. No one will remember you in that, and we both see it as our job to make the District 12 tributes unforgettable," says Cinna. "I'll be naked for sure," I think. "So rather than focus on the coal mining itself, we're going to focus on the coal," says Cinna. "Naked and covered in black dust," I think. "And what do we do with coal?"
"We burn it," says Cinna. "You're not afraid of fire, are you, Katniss?"
He sees my expression and grins. A few hours later, I am dressed in what will either be the most sensational or the deadliest costume in the opening ceremonies. I'm in a simple black unitard that covers me from ankle to neck. shiny leather boots lace up to my knees. But it's the fluttering cape